From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 31st installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR, and today we're going to dive in deep into Leon Trotsky. That's where we'll start. Who knows where we'll end up?
Thank you, Dan. Good to be with you.
The same.
Yep,
thank you.
We are doing that. And we're really looking at Trotsky in the 30s, and particularly 1938-39. We're skipping from what we were talking about, which was the 1917, his role in the 1917 October Revolution. But I'm skipping now to illuminate some of his ideas at the time that war was going to break out. So, a bit of a background, just because we did this months ago. So I'm going to summarize some bit. So in the 1930s, war in Europe was becoming a certainty. It would come sooner or later. Everybody knew that. The victory of fascism in Spain made it sooner than later. Fascist Italy and Nazi Germany had tested their weapons in the Civil War in Spain on the side of Franco, and had got the better of the Republican forces by 1939. Now, the Soviet Union had seen the threat of fascism to sovereign nations, but especially to the Soviet Union, as we know, very early in the 20s,
right,
before fascism was even born. But so it had seen the threat coming even before the Civil War broke out in Spain. So in 1935, delegates of the communist parties of the world gathered in Moscow to put together a strategic plan on what would be the best way to defeat fascism. Now, as we know, this was the meeting of the Sixth Comintern. It was decided at that time that the communist parties in each country where they operated legally would drop the politics of class confrontation and class conflict against bourgeois parties that had been the program of the Fifth Comintern of 1928. Now, this had been a period when capitalism had seemed weak and ready for overthrow. So, but with fascism, the capitalist countries had decided to go for broke and stamp out the threat of socialism. So the sixth, so the sixth Comintern decided to put the class struggle on the back burner. The overthrow of capitalism had to wait, while military fascism threatened the survival of whole nations. So the sixth Comintern therefore adopted a program of the United or Popular Front. And this was to be an alliance with all anti-fascist parties, liberal, social democrat, anarchist, etc. Now, this cooperation by revolutionary parties with bourgeois and non-revolutionary parties was simply an emergency measure, and in no way a permanent alliance with the bourgeoisie. However, Trotsky, who formed and headed the Fourth International in exile, in opposition to Lenin's Third International, I think that was 1919, which had become the platform of the Bolshevik Party in the Soviet Union since 1919, Trotsky called the Popular Front the betrayal of the internationalist task of the October Revolution of 1917 to carry out a world revolution. Now, this is his idea of permanent revolution, which we'll get to later on, a whole section on that. Now, to conclude the preamble, from 1935 to his death in 1940, Trotsky and Trotskyism took a position against alliances by communists with the bourgeoisie democracy in function of anti-fascism. They took a position of alliances in function of anti-fascism. Now, so this kind of alliance, they said, amounted to an alliance with imperialism. To his thinking, fascism and imperialism were two different things, separate from each other. And the greater evil was imperialism. Now, I think this was the first error in Trotsky's thinking in this regard, to separate fascism from imperialism.
Right.
How could he? We have the example. In Italy and in Germany, fascism acted as the vanguard army of imperialism.
Right.
Italy considered Libya its living space, the place where Italy could stretch out to relieve unemployment, seize resources, obtain markets, and enslave the native population for cheap labor. Ditto for Somalia and Ethiopia. I mean, fascism is imperialist. Hitler saw Russia, as we well know, and the East as his Lebensraum, Germany's Lebensraum,
right,
its own living space. And Trotsky could not know of Hitler's plans for Russia by 1938-39, which eventually, in a year before the invasion of Russia, became Plan Ost, which is the extermination of the Slav people to a certain percentage. I didn't put down, I don't have the notes, certain percentage. By hunger, by extermination, some enslaved, some sent to Germany as servants, etc., and labor, which happened during the war. So, now, I think I may be concluding this portion. To say that fascism is one thing and imperialism is another is theoretically unsound and politically divisive. The two are twins. And so I see this making this division. Fascism is one thing, you know, it's oppression of police and it's oppression. And imperialism is conquest, extermination of other nations, the nation state. And this is another big issue. You know, fascism is suppression of the people, police state, etc. Imperialism is just the evil intent of metropolitan capitalism to expand. In other words, yes, that is true, but that is not the whole truth. Lenin had a different interpretation of imperialism, mm-hmm. which involved monopoly capitalism, financial things. It was a system, not just an action. And we'll have to talk about that when we talk about permanent revolution. So,
right.
So he divided. So now, what is interesting is that we see this in the United States now. We see a division between fascism, as they perceive it, and imperialism. In time of rampant American imperialism, we see the left, whatever, you know, the left in the United States, that is the liberals, they call themselves left, and the radical left, if there is such a thing, we see the left in the United States ignore Hillary's imperialism in order to fight what they call Trump's fascism.
That's right. Yeah, you nailed that. That's exactly right.
I wanted to get to this, which took me, you know, it's been bothering me. So they ignore the, so you know, why you go to South Carolina, whatever, you know, you fight fascism there, because imperialism is totally different.
Right.
Imperialism is what everybody does. It's just, you know.
Yep. And so, you know, not for, so let's
yeah,
look
go
at
ahead
who,
now.
Let's look at who goes there. So, you know, a lot of the folks are, let's say, college students, recent college graduates. they can afford to travel, and they can afford the time to go to Carolina at the drop of a hat as part of political organizing effort. And they can afford to be mobilized. Okay, this is, you know, these are very different conditions here that we're talking about than people that are mobilized in within their own communities because they can't go anywhere else. So we're talking already about a particular class niche, if nothing else, okay?
And a particular what? I'm sorry.
Like a class, like a slice of a class.
A slice of a particular class.
That's right. So it has a class character. It's petty bourgeois. That's right. The class character. And so the very conditions that allow these folks to, you know, to organize, the very people organizing them, as a matter of fact, this all rests on imperialism. The wealth that supports their discretionary income, you know, the trickle that they get out of it, is what imperialism is stealing from around the world. It's the political equivalent or the national equivalent of white privilege writ large, only within the system of imperialism instead of within the system of white supremacy, as if there were they could be distinguished, but you know, to the extent you can distinguish them and must distinguish them, you're looking at the global system, imperialism, providing the material wherewithal for these folks to be protesting, and they do not protest imperialism. And further, within the larger struggle that's going on right now, among imperialists, there are the imperialists who are hegemons. They want they call it the United States, but they want the military power that's, you know, in the whose title is in the name of the United States, that belongs to them, to be the prevalent sole power globally. The other faction is looking at multilateralism, in other words, multiple centers of power distributed among the elites of multiple nation states, Russia, China, South Korea, Japan, European Union, whatever. And Trump represents the latter, and the entire rest of the political establishment represents the former. That's been policy, not just since PNAC articulated it in their document, but, you know, since really since Ronald Reagan and earlier.
Oh, yes.
And that's what the great cry coming out of, you know, what they call the deep state, but coming out of the media, coming out from across the country, that cry is over a change in policy that's just been threatened to occur, hasn't even occurred yet, that we might pursue a policy that acknowledges the rights of other actors on the global stage and engages them within that construct. That is the big offense of Trump to the establishment. And those are the two forces that are struggling over the question of imperialism right now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about this. It seems, I've written about it, Trump has delegated military decision over Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan. What was that, a compromise, the old establishment pulling plausible deniability? What was it?
Well, okay, first of all, I'm going to answer the question, but I don't mean to imply that I actually know, okay? These are things us are unknowable, of course. But this is my reading of events, you know, given what I do know, whatever that value that might have. First of all, you have to look at, there has been a very active battle going on, even with casualties, between the Pentagon and Langley, you know, between the Pentagon and the CIA, in essence.
Yeah.
On the ground in Syria, you had, you know, basically the military backing this group of fighters in Syria, the CIA backing that group of fighters in Syria, engagement of one against the other with casualties.
Yep.
So, you know, there is, to say competition, I think, leaves out the essential military character of the conflict between the two, that they were in effect already in a state of war. Now, Trump comes into power, this is my reading, Trump comes into power with the antipathy.
Within this conflict.
Within this conflict, and as the target of a conflict, by the CIA and the intel agencies, they clearly, people have their opinion about this. If you look honestly at the material around Russiagate, quote unquote, and particularly around the FISA application, the one that's been exposed Trump guy, it's clear that this is an excuse for them to wiretap the campaign. They were actors. They were playing, dropping, information into the narrative all the way through. They were, the CIA, whoever else, the intel agencies, were very actively engaged in trying to get Hillary Clinton elected president or appointed or whatever. And as a matter of fact, in my opinion, the public relations campaign that we're looking at is also coming from there. This is exactly what they do everywhere else in the world as they engineer a coup or an invasion or both or whatever. So, and this happens here within a year of Obama authorizing those intelligence agencies to do exactly that, which had been forbidden since the National Security Act in 1946 or 47 or whatever it was, when they created the CIA. So, this whole game is afoot. Trump comes into it. Intel is against him. There's only one other player that's got guns involved. It's the military. So you go to them and you say, okay, look, my enemy, your enemy. You guys are in charge of foreign policy. Deal with them first. That's what I see going now. I don't know if that's what's going on, but I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, well, I thought that was going on from the beginning. That is, and I put it in these terms, that there is a war within the ruling class, and that there are interests behind it. But you're identifying the CIA and the Pentagon as being at loggerheads, I agree with. Now, remember that even that Michael Flynn, was he Flynn?
Yeah, right, Michael Flynn,
In 2015, I quoted in the essay I have in Counterpunch, what was really, really, really targeting the CIA. He said, he said many things, but, there's a quotation. Can you read it aloud? It's significant. It's 2015, which attacks the CIA for its drone program.
Yep. The drone campaign right now is really only about killing. When you hear the phrase capture, kill, capture is actually a misnomer. In the drone strategy that we have, capture is a lowercase c. We don't capture people anymore. Our entire Middle East policy seems to be based on firing drones. That's what this administration decided to do in its counterterrorism campaign. They're enamored by the ability of special operations and the CIA to find a guy in the middle of the desert in some S-word, little village, and drop a bomb on his head and kill him. That's what Flynn commented on back in, in 2015. That's right, before his appointment in 2017, in 2015.
Before he was involved with Trump and his appointment for 3 weeks in 2018.
Right.
Now, clearly there is the voice of the Pentagon.
That's right, I gotcha. Well, of course, though. The CIA, the CIA doesn't need the Pentagon and doesn't need the military if they've got drones. All you need is a guy in a closet somewhere with a joystick and a monitor. They got plenty of those.
Yeah, and then Flint continues, or was it some other in my article? Some other general who was ejected by the Obama administration. I said this is creating great problems for the United States, problems of reputation, all kinds of blowback possibilities, because this is the most illegal war you can possibly imagine. This war, this drone war, violates sovereign states.
That's right.
It doesn't take in the pursuit of the war on terror, in the clause of the 60 words that gives the president the authority to do whatever he likes, essentially, if it means so-called protecting the lives of the United States. If there is a terrorist in Thailand, the drone will penetrate. That's the only excuse they have. If there is a terrorist in Thailand, you can just violate sovereignty and bomb somebody in Thailand.
Right.
Some village in Thailand.
Right.
So it is clear from what Flynn said that the policy of the CIA and Obama's policy in Syria was military in the completely wrong sense. And right. I also add that this conflict between the CIA and the Pentagon dates back to Vietnam.
Yeah, we know that it does, actually, for sure. And you know, it's hard to, you know, there's an old saying that I'm not going to use that deals with uncertain parentage and et cetera. When you're in a room full of such folks, it's hard to know, you know, who's the good guy and who the bad guy is, because, you know, the dispute between the Pentagon and Langley back in the Vietnam War, for example, one of the disputes was the Pentagon was like, look, we got all these nuclear weapons, let's just bomb the hell out of them. And the Pentagon saying, and Langley saying, we don't know about that.
Yes.
Now, you know, this is after Dulles was gone, because he was, you know, in favor of a whole lot of stuff that, you know.
Well, he wanted to give France 3 nuclear bombs.
Yep, that's right, to use.
To use over Indochina,
yep.
You know, which became, and they said no.
That's right. France said, we ain't that crazy. So, okay, as crazy as France was, they weren't that crazy, okay? We had Waterloo, Napoleon, all kinds of funny stuff, a lot of guillotine things, but we ain't dropping 3 nuclear bombs on Indochina, okay? So that's too crazy for us.
Yeah, so I'm glad we agree on this point of that, try to post. On this point that there is a tremendous struggle between the establishment, and I would call the establishment the Council on Foreign Relations, the State Department, the media associated with it, that they're just servants, but the whole establishment versus the Pentagon. You can call the Pentagon crazy, but it's supposed to know how to do war.
Right. That's
and
right.
The thing that the CIA did, in essence, was to lose Syria.
Yeah.
I mean, the methods and the strategy that Obama chose, he's a complete failure. His foreign policy is a failure.
But see, here's the problem for them. They have a legal problem, which is why the CIA... Right, exactly. The problem that they have is that there is no legal route to a military involvement, in other words, basically to a U.S. invasion of Syria without the Security Council authorizing it. And when Russia and China showed that no more Libyas and vetoed the first resolutions, then rather than drop the matter, they then shifted to, you know, CIA and ops, quote unquote. And so what we saw was now, to be clear, we saw that in Libya as well, because the political problem that Bush faced still took place in Iraq.
We had
millions of people out a month before he started the war. I mean, it was well understood that it was going to happen. But, you know, February 15th, 2003, huge turnout in the snow up here in the Northeast,
All over the world, 3 million in Rome.
Yeah, around the world.
3 million in Milan, Indonesia, Malaysia.
Around the world. And now Obama, no less, comes into office supposedly as, you know, an opponent of that war. Also, you know, making speeches about nuclear disarmament. And, you know, he's being treated even by Fidel Castro and Gaddafi and others as the third world and all that. It's kind of harsh for him to turn around and do the same thing. So what they did was they had the CIA organize all the irregulars on the ground. They had basically Al-Qaeda as the ground troops. and yeah, got authority to do with the air. Just the Pentagon got the Air Force. That's all. You guys take out their air defenses, take out their strongholds here and there, and you know, level everything there, and Langley's Al Qaeda dudes will take care of the rest.
In other words, we are in charge here, and you are our subordinate, and you just use the tools that we tell you to use.
Right.
We don't go with your policy. You don't draft anything.
That's right. So, you know, Trump comes into power
in
that situation. And now, see, Trump's disagreement, it did happen in Vietnam. Their disagreement with Trump now that takes place over policy. In other words, the policy is multilateralism against hegemony, essentially. You know, the CIA, those guys are the instruments of hegemony, in essence. You know, the military, the threat of the military and also the use of the military has been an enforcer of hegemony, but the operation really runs through CIA and such. And so, you know, suddenly the heresy that Trump speaks and the reality that's presenting on the ground, whether you start with the creation of ALBA or the creation of the African Union or the SCO or CELAC or BRICS or whatever, the whole world is moving towards this multilateral model on the ground. And it's, you know, the U.S. policy is so ill-fitted to what's going on. This is presenting, and Trump rides in on that. And the CIA is the base of reaction because they've been the manager of hegemony.
Yeah. The only question I have, definitely the CIA has landed, the Phoenix has landed fully over this whole, particularly the Obama administration. I mean, it was just handed over. The whole hegemonic plan was execution was handed to the CIA, and they failed.
That's right.
But my question about Trump is, and it's a question of imperialism. Does he want to pull the United States back from imperialism or not? And the second question is, can U.S. capitalism survive without imperialism?
Well,
is Trump being naive in saying or thinking or whatever that this is a multipolar war and world and we have to adjust to it? Does he really say that? And if he says it, when is he going to be executed?
Yeah, or when is he going to be executed, which is maybe on the agenda of the CIA. And we have to stop here.
No,
we mentioned Trotsky.
I mean?
Yes,
I'm
we do, but
sure
we're out of time.
Trump is an anti-imperialist. That's what I want to know.
Understood. I understand that. We got to stop now because we're out of time. But we'll pick up here. But maybe we'll go back to Trotsky next week because we kind of left him in the dust. And Luciana, thank you very much. I appreciate it. This has been very enjoyable.
Thank you so much, Don. Have fun. Bye.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.